I start again. I'm Emma, I'm an addict. I'm really nervous, and I always get nervous before sharing, and I think that's a good thing in some ways. It's quite humbling, and it's really important to me to be here, so thanks for inviting me, the committee, and it's really nice to see loads of people here. It's been a big part of my recovery, Plymouth. So yeah, I'm really pleased to be here, and hopefully I can just share a little bit about how I got here and what I'm continuing to do for my recovery. Yeah, it's really hard for me not to plan what I'm going to say at these things, because I think for my entire life, I've attempted to control every element of my life using my own will. So even on the drive down here, I'm kind of running through things that I could say, like actually have to stop myself from doing that. And that kind of is representative of how I live my life now, constantly in a battle with my head to stop manipulating situations, and my head runs off quite often still and tells me things that aren't true. And I think with sharing, for me in particular, there's only one version of the truth. And for a long time, I didn't recognize that to be true. I guess I'm trying to say I lied a lot. but I didn't know I was lying. And I think that delusion is the most difficult part of addiction often. You can't see the truth. And I think for me, being able to see the truth is the most important part of my recovery. So I'll just begin by saying a little bit about what I used to be like. I guess for a long time, I thought I was a person that just really liked taking drugs and drinking. I just thought it was an intrinsic part of my personality. My friend Kai, who's here, often says he just thought it was a habit, just like, or a hobby. So I thought that taking copious amounts of cocaine was like just what I did, the way some people like listening to music or going to the gym. What I didn't realize, and this was right up until the very end of my using, was that that was the illness itself that was telling me that what I was doing was fun. When actually the reality, now that I look back at it, without the sort of cloud of substances in my way, it was a really depressing way to live. And now I've got to the point where I do think about drinking and using. Those things pop up for me because it was such a kind of knee-jerk response to any discomfort. But I no longer view that way of life as attractive anymore. But in order to have got there, I need to be constantly surrounded by recovery. And what that looks like for me, I'll go into in a bit. So I came into CA 19 months ago today, actually. So, yeah. Yeah. And, to say that my life is unrecognisable from what it was, it would be a massive understatement. When I came in, I'd lost pretty much everything. I could no longer work, so I'm a teacher, so I lost the ability to do that job, which was hugely important to me. I was no longer welcome with my family, so I had no real place to live. But most of all, I kind of lost any sense of who I was as a person. I'd been robbed, or I'd robbed myself, really, of any kind of identity that had anything to do with anything other than using drugs and drinking. It was my whole life. It was, it was the sun around which my life orbited, using drugs. Everything about my life was geared towards when the next time I could take a drug was, or when the next time I could start drinking was. And in the end, what happened to me is that my life kind of closed in on itself. I ended up in a sort of tiny flat above a shop in outer London, and I would get up, because I'm not working at this point, I would get up and kind of wait for the day to end. So it was dark enough for me to go out and meet my dealer. And I would just sit there alone and be using drugs. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I think for a lot of us, until we come into the rooms, I had no idea of what addiction meant. I had no idea that it was an illness. I thought for a long time that was a cop-out. I had no idea that actually, once I put down the substances, it was actually what was going on in my head. That's my real problem. And I suppose that kind of makes sense to me looking back on my life. As a child, I was very introverted, you know, very sensitive, unable to regulate emotions. I'm still like that now, which I'll go into in a bit. But I was very morbid as a child. So I would lie in bed. I remember from about the age of three, I have these memories of lying in bed and thinking about like things like when the world was going to end and if it did, what I would be able to do to stop it. So there you've got like major fear and kind of self-esteem, but also like this huge ego that means I'm constantly thinking about what I can do to change situations or save people or whatever it is. So I've got this personality that hates being the center of attention, but then gets pissed off when I'm not. And wonders why. And, you know, I'm driven by, like it says in the book, these 100 forms of fear, mainly to do with how people see me or what people think of me. And a lot of that stuff's nonsense. You know, mostly it's my head. And in particular, this kind of, you know, obsessive part of this illness that tells me constantly people are judging me, that I'm not good enough, that I'm going to fail. And that fear drove me even before I'd picked up a substance, you know, that sort of gnawing, uncomfortable, it's discomfort. And I'm really shit at dealing with discomfort, which is why when I eventually picked up a drink and a drug and it temporarily eased that, I thought I found the kind of key to life here. And I think that's what I hear again and again in the rooms. It's that kind of sort of false or fake temporary ease that sort of pulls you in, and then before you know it, that is your go-to, and then, you know, every milestone that I've gone through in my life has been dealt with using that substance, so that when I've come into recovery, and I'll go into it, everything now that I'm experiencing, getting a new job, moving into a home, getting into a relationship, all that stuff is now happening to me for the first time, really, and that's what recovery is about dealing with those things as they come up for the first time for all of us. I've heard it said a lot, you're kind of the age you are when you picked up. So I guess that would put me about 13, which is great. Because at 13, I was a fucking nightmare. You know, I was just a ball of anxiety. I mean, the fear that I've experienced as a child and growing up has served me in some ways. You know, I think I dealt with my fear and anxiety and my kind of need to be seen as impressive by putting in a shitload of work at school. And I ended up doing really well and moving to London. And also on the outside, I'm achieving all of these things and getting these great jobs and doing life. But behind the scenes, my addiction's already starting to manifest itself in a number of different ways. So I drank alcoholically from the get-go. I think I was arrested for being drunk and disorderly my second time drinking on Tor Abbey in Torquay, which was highly embarrassing for my family. Like, my dad was a solicitor in the local community at the time and had to pick me up from the the police station, which wasn't great. So the consequences started happening for me almost immediately after I picked up a drink. At the time when you're in your sort of teens, early 20s, even early 30s actually, you sort of see that other people are drinking alongside you. And, you know, I was a party girl. That's kind of the image that I portrayed for a long time. And the reality really is that, yes, I was on the nights that I went out with people. But for me, those people would go home to their family or to their boyfriend or, you know, whatever, and stop. And I would not do that. And I failed to realise that that was what was really going on. So from the get-go, I was unable to stop once I started. I thought that was normal. I thought blacking out was like a normal thing to happen when you went out. I was actually disappointed when I woke up and could remember what had gone on. You know, I just thought that was normal. Up until like 19 months ago, you know, and I started to experience like that sort of craving, like the mental twist as well. Like, once I knew I was going to be around alcohol or have access to it, I just couldn't get it out of my mind. It's a true obsession for me. And so what happens in those situations is that you're not able to be fully present in your life at all. Even before it gets so shit that you can't function, you don't function properly because that need to not be present is just always there. And when I first came into recovery, I did think to myself a lot, what could I have achieved if I hadn't had that all the time? That's not helpful. So I wouldn't recommend that. And actually, the longer you stay in recovery, you do learn what you can achieve anyway. So I'd recommend sticking around. So I guess it got really bad. Just checking time. When I sort of hit my mid-20s to late 20s, I started to suffer quite significant mental health effects from drinking. My mind isn't optimistic. So as a child, I'm fantasizing about the world ending. But as an adult, you know, those things started to really become unmanageable for me. And you know, I joke quite a lot in meetings about like sitting in my flat and listening to Leonard Cohen and crying into the mirror. But in reality, that's what I did quite a lot of the time. You know, I am prone to morbidity and like depression, even without a substance, actually. I quite like darkness. But like, you know, I've always been interested in like, I think sort of alcoholic writers. I was really obsessed at one point with Hunter S. Thompson. Like, I was just like really drawn towards those kind of artistic addict types. And that romanticized everything I was doing. So I would be in my flat like writing depressing poetry, which I've sort of burned now because it's hideous and really embarrassing. But, you know, again, that delusion, isn't it? Like, this is okay because, like, those people did it. And I'd be really kind of into, you know, addict musicians and things like that. And, you know, those people don't end up surviving. But I blocked that out quite, you know, you get really good at compartmentalizing things. And I just dismissed things that didn't fit with the narrative that I had for my life, which was that I was a hedonist. I just like drinking and taking drugs. Just leave me alone. This is fine. I'm functioning. I've got a job. I've got a flat. And of course, it can't continue like that. We know that this is a progressive illness. And like I said, it progressed for me first mentally. My dad calls them like episodes or like, you know, that time when I had to come and stage that intervention. That started happening kind of intermittently. The thing with my addiction is that it never sort of, it didn't steadily decline until the very end when it did rapidly, but actually it was more peaks and troughs. So I was fooled into thinking that actually I could get a handle on it because there were periods of time when I had it under control and I managed to get a better job or I got a new boyfriend, so surely I'm not an addict. I can do all these things, and I've got friends. Actually, what I was doing was using those jobs and using those boyfriends as a kind of sticking plaster to fix whatever was wrong with me. I didn't know what was wrong with me, and so obviously it's never going to work, but I lived with this kind of constant sort of vague belief that one day it would be all right. One day, something would happen, and magically, I'm going to not drink so much anymore, and you know, I'm going to stop smashing my life up. It never happened, because no matter where I went, what job I was doing, which boyfriend I had, I had this innate ability to seek out people that were exactly like me, who would accompany me in this kind of mad journey, and would always be up all night. And actually what ended up happening as well was that even those people, you know, the people that I had identified as the most insane and the most like me, they would get sick of me eventually. You know, even at uni when everybody's drinking, they don't want to be around me because they can't keep up, or they don't want to keep up most likely. Or when I drink, I'm not a good person. And when I do drugs, I turn into a monster. You know, self-obsessed, depressing, just really sort of an empty vessel that just is honed in on the next opportunity to get fucked up. And that's not a nice person to be around at all. And of course, what happens then is that you use that and you become self-pitying. That was a huge part of my using. Oh, why does nobody want to be around me? Why will no one stay up with me till 5 a.m., like when we're supposed to be teaching tomorrow? You know, that sort of stuff. And it's really dangerous. That kind of mindset's really dangerous. And if I'm not careful, I can slip into that now, that kind of self-centered, I'm the victim, everyone in the world is around me, and what against me. And what I know to be true now is that it's just bollocks. It's absolute nonsense. And it's my head. It's totally my head. And without something in my life that deals with that, of course I'm going to get to the point where picking up drugs again looks like a good idea, and it looks like the only way that I can quiet things down. How am I doing for time? All right. Okay. Yeah, so I guess I want to talk about recovery more than my behaviour, but I think I'll just mention what happened at the end, because we all have that point, don't we, where it's the jumping off point. And I honestly, I do not know why this time was different. It's one of the things that I still can't work out, you know, when you're in a meeting and you see people coming back and they don't seem to be getting it. And I often think, why was it my time? And I don't suppose that matters. I think it's different for everybody. And I think, you know, I had tried probably not everything, but everything I was willing to try, I had done before I'd come to the fellowship. And actually, I think it got to the point where I could no longer ignore the consequences of what I'd done. And I think the biggest thing is that I realised that I could not do anything about it myself anymore. And for somebody like me that is, you know, driven by ego and, you know, my own capabilities to fix things, that was a point that took me quite a long time to get to. And what happened for me was that, yeah, like I said, I wasn't able to work. My mum had passed away quite suddenly. She was 50 years old. You know, it was really tragic what happened. And I don't say that for sympathy. I say it to demonstrate how this illness robs you of any kind of compassion for other humans, because I made my mum's death entirely about me and used it as an excuse to get worse and not better. And I was unable to help my family. I remember this one time we were up in Yorkshire where she'd passed away, and you know, I'm supposed to be there, like, writing a eulogy and helping out with funeral arrangements because I'm the next of kin. And actually, all I'm thinking is, when are my grandma and granddad going to fucking leave this house so that I can drink? That is their daughter that they've lost. They're my grandparents, and I'm wishing them out of the house so that I can just get on with drinking and taking drugs. And I think that's okay, because my mum's died and I deserve it. Realistically, actually, the reality is, I would have been doing that sort of stuff anyway, regardless of whether my mum had passed away. I'd been doing it for years. And really, it took me another couple of years to get into recovery. But that was the beginning of the sort of steep decline to rock bottom. And I just then really went for it. I didn't really care about living a normal life anymore. And I'd accepted that my life was going to be like this. I'd accepted that I was incapable of stopping once I started. And so I just arranged my life around that. So my routine was just ridiculous. You know, I would tutor privately whilst I'm supposed to be off work sick, and use all the cash that I'm making to teach children to buy drugs. And just that happened day in, day out. Mental. I'm like marking GCSEs, like actual GCSEs for kids, off my face. Again, the selfishness is just ridiculous. But so I reached a point where my mental health had got bad, you know, because I've got no perspective. Like, the other part of this for me is that on my own, I have no perspective. I don't know the true from the false. And one day I'm fine, and the next I'm not. And, you know, one day I just ended up like shoving a load of medication into my mouth. I remember it vividly. And the reason I did it wasn't because I wanted to die. It really wasn't that dramatic. It was that I didn't care whether I lived or died. And I think something had happened, like I'd run out of wine and I didn't have any money to buy any more. And I genuinely think that's... I just thought, well... So you're kind of... you know, it's that thing. Like, I knew I couldn't keep doing it, but I didn't know how I was gonna not do it. I couldn't see my life as anything different to what it was, and therefore I didn't really care if I was around anymore. So my heart stopped, and I was resuscitated in hospital in London. And I remember saying to my dad the next day, I think maybe I should stop drinking. Like, you know, even at this point, I've nearly died from taking drugs, abusing like prescription meds, drinking, and I still can't see that this is my problem. I think it's my solution still. And I came back to Devon kind of just in a terrible way, and then I continued for about a week, which is when I just smashed to pieces, like, my dad. You know, his opinion of me at that point couldn't have been lower, and I blamed him for that, obviously. He should have all this sympathy for me. You know, he's had to come up to London twice to kind of hold my hand in hospital and check me into a psych unit and all of this. And I'm thinking, how dare he? It's his fault I drink anyway, because he drinks loads, and, you know, all of this stuff. Anyway, so I came into the fellowship, I think, as a very, very last resort. I didn't believe in God. I was openly contemptuous of religion, actually. And obviously, before I understood that this isn't a religious program, I had no spirituality in my life at all. No faith, no hope, no courage, which is ironic that I'm presenting on that now. But I had none of that. You know, I hated being around anyone who had any inkling or any sort of vibe of spirituality or happiness about them, because I was intrinsically unhappy, and I wanted everybody to not be unhappy, but I didn't want to be around anyone that made me feel like I was different, even though I thought I was special and different. it's an illness of contradiction, isn't it? But, like, anyway, so I came in, and I just, for the first time, I guess, felt like I wasn't alone, which scared me, actually, because I had orchestrated my life, so I had been alone for a long time. And so breaking through that kind of initial discomfort was hard. But actually, I saw in the rooms people who had recovered, and I heard what they had to say, and I was willing to listen to a point. You know, I still fought with things for a while, actually. You know, the God thing, I had to get my head around that. I had to deal with, you know, resentments. I didn't understand what that meant. You know, I just had been angry for a long time and not knew why. And I also had to understand that actually, if I'm to believe what this stuff tells me and what it says in the big book, then there is no hope of me getting better. You know, I'm not going to be able to one day pick up a glass of wine and drink like a lady. You hear that quite a lot. I mean, I don't know what that looks like. I've never had a glass of wine. Any time I've ever tried controlled drinking or using, I've hated every minute of it. And felt really resentful towards whoever it was that was making me control my drinking or using. Like, so that's not an option for me. I am that type that cannot stop once they begin. And I truly believe that if I were to pick up a drug or a drink now, it would be game over. I don't think I could recover mentally. I'd got to such a point where I couldn't do anything that resembled functioning. So I kind of accepted that, and I think that was enough for me to get cracking. And I got a sponsor, I think about a week after I first went to a meeting, and just started working through the program. And I was willing. I think, I was half willing. I'm sort of careful because my sponsor's here. She'd probably say you weren't willing at all. But I did the work, I think. I am quite conscientious, and I think I really cared about getting things right. So I immediately got out my like pen and started annotating things and like making spreadsheets. And she just said, just don't do that. Just read stuff and take it in, and you know, and understand, try and understand what it means. And I try to do that now, even to the point where I didn't plan what I'm going to say, which is madness for me. But what I've learned in recovery is that there are two things that have given me faith. Like I said, I didn't trust God, I didn't believe in it. I don't know what my higher power is now, I'm going to be honest, but I believe that I have one. Too many things have happened to me in recovery for it not to be coincidental, and it's certainly not me that's doing it. I think what I've just told you about my life proves that I've got no manageability, I've got no ability to know what's best for me, no perspective. You know, in the last 19 months, I've learned that the biggest thing that gives you any faith at all, or me, is time. You know, like I said, I started off this journey as a kind of a newborn. You know, every experience I've had throughout the last 19 months has been for the first time. And of course, that fills me with absolute dread every time something happens that's a new milestone, getting a new job, you know, moving into my own flat again. All of that has been highly stressful for me. And at times I've thought my recovery is in jeopardy because I felt so out of control. But of course, because I've never done those things without using or drinking before. And as an addict, anything that causes me discomfort, whether that be good or bad, like excitement's a really big thing for me. Even if I feel like massive excitement or happiness, I want to get fucked up because that's uncomfortable. Like, even though it's good, it's really uncomfortable. And I'm a wimp when it comes to discomfort. Like, I just don't want to do it. And that's as simple as that. Like, every time I feel uncomfortable, I get a phone call I don't want to answer, or there's something I have to do for my job that I just don't want to do, like talk to someone that I don't particularly like. You know, I want to use something to eradicate that discomfort. The only thing that's going to do that is not a drink or a drug, that's going to ruin my life, is this program. And, you know, I'm not perfect. I don't do, you know, recently I've got into a relationship, and that's been the biggest test, actually. And, you know, it's, for me, who wants everything to be perfect and wants everyone to like me and wants everybody to think I'm the best, recovery is sometimes really hard. It's really hard because I've got to accept every single day that I do not have control. I've got to hand it over. And the only way I do that is by practicing these steps. And my morning routine is very much step three centric. So it's all about just, you know, please, God, show me the right way to behave. Or what is the truth? What is the truth? You know, I'm incapable of seeing the truth. And if I stop doing this stuff for one day, even one day, I begin to believe my own bullshit again. Because when I don't reach out to people, when I don't help others, when I don't do service, when I don't go to meetings and hear this constantly, I begin to lose that perspective that this stuff gives me. And working with others is so important because I'm really good at looking at someone else's life and going, ah, okay, let's talk about this and this is what I did. When it comes to looking at my own life, I'm rubbish. And I think we all are. And I think that's why sponsorship is sort of integral. And I think I would urge anyone who hasn't got one to get one. How long have I got? 1 minute. you know, to talk about hope, faith, and courage, I think really the my only message is that I finally got some, and that's a miracle. It really is, and I hope somebody has got something out of what I said. I really cannot thank the fellowship enough and praise it to enough people. Because it saved my life, and not only that, it's given me a life that actually I'm happy in, and that I want to get up in the morning. Who knew that I was a morning person? But I am now. So thanks for listening to me, and I think I'll leave it there. Thank you.